thank you. It's good. I was worried I would have to wear a winter coat, and then it would actually give my lecture a winter coat, because in California, if it's 50, we think we're in a cold wave. Now, when I first moved to California, I didn't mind very much. I think this is the third time, or fourth time, I can't remember which, that I've been to the Field Institute. I'm glad to be back again. I think I've talked about golf, and I always try to talk about something different. Mostly my work now is on acquisition of expertise by the nervous system, but which I'm not going to talk about today, and how the nervous system controls balance and things like that. But one of my original laws was epilepsy, and I thought I would give you a summary of the kind of work we're doing to see if maybe you guys might be interested. Okay. I always use the we, okay, and we, these are the people. I think one of the advantages I've had in my life is I've always been able to collaborate with good people. Sometimes I say gullible people who will actually try to work on some of the crazy ideas I come up with. Okay, and that's been one of my real advantages. And then I have a long-time connection to Toronto. I'm from Nova Scotia, and this is me at 11 years old. And this broken arm and my fame when I was 11 years old was that Bobby Bond, who was a defenseman for the Toronto Maple Leafs in the 60s, actually took a shot at a hockey school and broke my arm. Now, he didn't break it this bad. But you know, when you get older and you tell stories about things in the past, they always get more dramatic, right? And so that's right. So everything gets extrapolated and things like that. So the challenge we're going to try to talk about a little bit today is how do you go from this is a picture of a neuron, and I have a population of neurons. And this is the EEG, and you have to have a degree in neurology to see that something started here, which is very different than the background on the other side, and this is a seizure. And what I want to know is how do I think about a seizure dynamical theory, and why did it stop? Okay, and that's the kind of things that off and on over the years I've always been working on, and you'll see that it's taken me in a rather strange journey. You know, so I didn't actually sit down and decide to do the problem all in an epilepsy suite. I tried to follow my imagination and do experiments to try to understand parts of this. Now, there are different kinds of models. You guys are real mathematicians, so you might decide to develop a really quantitative model, which is very detailed. You can reproduce the advantage of such approaches to try to reproduce experimentally the observed dynamics, and there are models that do that very well now. And my problem is that when you get to lots and lots of neurons, sometimes the important principles get lost in all the details. Okay, and so my approach is really to be more qualitative, because I allow to motivate that way. I almost always am stuck with just the principles because I can't go any further, and I can't make quantitative predictions. That might be a disadvantage, but on the other hand, I think trying to identify the principle is really what I'm interested in. So we're going to try to understand from a principle point of view what is going to be likely the area I think that what is going on when seizure begins and ends and things, and let you guys work out the details. Over the years, I've decided to start, and this is like something after 25 years of thinking about that, from seizure to non-seizure, from a non-seizure state to a seizure state and back again, okay, there are two-event models, okay? Two-event means you have an event that starts the seizure, and then you have to postulate a second event which stops the seizure. And so a long time ago with Michael Mackey and Leon Glass, I was interested in the models of epilepsy as a dynamic disease, where you imagine a parameter, let's say, going across going to a bifurcation, so on one side of the bifurcation, no seizure, on the other side, there's a seizure, and once you get the seizure going, then you have to imagine that either that parameter goes backwards, or another parameter changes to stop it, okay? Another possibility, and we'll talk a little bit about this, is the idea of multi-stability. In other words, I have two basins of attraction. One basin of attraction is normal brain activity, the other one's a seizure. Some perturbation knocks me from one basin to the other. Seizure starts, and now another perturbation has to come in and knock me out. Okay. There are one-event models, and I'm going to actually talk more about these. One-event models means that the seizure and length are already determined by one event. And these can, for example, be phenomena that occur in scale-free dynamical systems, like earthquakes and things like that, or an edge of stability phenomena, which is where I really want to end up. And when I'm talking about edge of stability, I mean that if I have a potential, that's a double well potential. So here's a fixed attract point here and a fixed point here. These ones are stable, but I'm actually going to talk about what happens up here. And then my whole take-home message is that when a time delay is in the system, there are really weird and wonderful things that happen up here. And that's basically where the message is going to get. And all of you guys can now leave the room and I'll just talk to myself, okay? No, please don't. So my way of doing this was along, you know, if you go back enough, when I started off thinking about this in the 80s when I went to University of Chicago, running an epilepsy center, and we had the idea that that when we were trying to identify where the seizure begins, we would actually lay a grid of electrodes over the surface of the person's brain and then try to find, so when you have those, all these electrodes sitting here, obviously the electrode where the seizure begins is the area of the brain that probably is the epileptic focus. Okay, if that's in an area of brain that's not very important, which means that if I put a stimulus in, I don't get a response, then I can cut that area of the brain out with the hope that the seizures would stop. But on the other hand, you could think of, well, if that was the seizure that's where the seizure's beginning, maybe I don't really have to remove that area of cortex, I just have to disconnect it so it can't spread. So our original problem we started off at University of Chicago was trying to understand how seizures spread in a network of neurons, okay? And back in this time, this is Art Winfrey and people like that, you know, if you make an integrate and fire neuron network of neurons and you assume, well, you don't even have to do that, you can do red, blue, and white, which means you, when the neuron is active, you color it red, the next time step it becomes blue, and after that it becomes white, and you now start playing around the dynamics. If you have a barrier in there, you can actually trigger a traveling spiral wave, okay? And what we came along and said, well, in epilepsy, it's the connectivity of the neurons that we think is off. So that's now make randomly connected integrating fire neurons with no barrier. And what we showed is if you now put a stimulus in the middle, and this is just numerical, you put a stimulus in the middle, you have a wave going out like the ripples in a pond, okay? But at some point, it goes through a symmetry breaking thing and a traveling spiral wave comes out. So my original idea in the University of Chicago was that maybe seizure spreads were like traveling spiral waves. Okay, this turned out to have some truth to it. For example, now this is from Steve Schiff's lab. This is now a piece of rat cortex. Okay, it's not, so you remember the cortex, if here's the surface, it's in six layers. All this is about 1 to 3 millimeters thick, okay? And what they're going to do is they cut this sort of at an angle like that to do this experiment. The cutting was very, and they're going to block away all the inhibition, so there's only excitation, which is true also in the model I just showed you. And this is a voltage-sensitive dye. Okay, so what you're seeing is the colors represent colors of different neurons, and I think they're stimulating somewhere here in the middle. This is now experimental data. Here you see, you can do the same thing that we were doing, and then all of a sudden, so it's true that if you make tissue this way, that there is a thing. And so we thought, well, this is really wonderful. It's exactly what we predicted. We must be in making hay. And so here are my two colleagues. I tried to put pictures in here, and I'm glad the audience is, I know there's not a lot of people here I know exactly, so that means I didn't miss any of your pictures, because I got really worried about having pictures in. But this is Jean-Paul Speer and Leo Toll, two of my colleagues at University of Chicago, and Kurt Hickox. Here's the brain, if you want, with lots of little electrodes over it. Students always complain that if I show this before lunch, that's not good, okay? And each one of those dots represents an electrode, okay? And you put a patch of them on the brain, okay, and now you can see what happens when a seizure spreads, and the seizure doesn't spread in spirals. It more or less just sits there. And if I wish I had the movie, but if you know those little toys that the kids make, and you hit down the peg here, the peg pops up over here, and then you hit that peg down and this one goes up, that's how a seizure spreads. Okay, and to convince you that, now, this is John Hunter, who was a graduate student and a postdoc. And for those of you who know PyLab, Python, he is the inventor of PyLab. So anybody uses PyLab for their things like that. And what he and students did is they made a picture. Now, what they're going to look at in this movie is they're going to look at the correlation of the activity between pairs of electrodes. Okay, and when there's significant correlation, they're actually going to draw a line connecting those. Okay. And that's what the movie is actually going to show, and it's going to show what happens to the correlation between the electrodes that are on the brain. It's about 128 plus 64, whatever that adds up to. You're the mathematician. So 180 something electrodes on the brain when they're doing this. And so what happens here This was made for the Discovery Channel. So the thing you should notice here is this is not like we were thinking, is that there are jumps, right? It's jumping over electrodes, and you can see underneath things are not going how we might have expected, right? Because we were thinking these things were going to move across a layer, which means it would be like an oil drop. If you imagine the beginning as an oil drop, you just have activity, the correlation between electrodes just kind of spreading out like that. It's not doing that at all. Okay? In fact, it disappeared. And but that reminds you, if for those of us who had forgotten our anatomy, is you do have to take the fact that the brain is connected to it. Okay? And on the horizontal surface, conduction is slow, because those are myelinated factor fibers, okay, and they conduct very, very slowly. And the myelinated ones, which are the fast conductors, are down. Okay, and for example, going to deep nuclei and now spread back out, or you can go along like that. Okay, and so if you want to go to between what is the fastest route of conduction between, let's say, two points on the cortex A and B, it's not horizontally in the surface, but it's the indirect route going fast and down. So what's really happening in this movie is we're using all these long pathways. From my point of view, said, well, that's all very nice, but I think it defeats any purpose for me trying to model this thing, because unless I know exactly the anatomy, I'm in deep trouble. Okay. Now, fortunately, when I was a crazy resident in neurology, I did a weird experiment. The experiment was, I had a patient, so we can imagine at the Montreal Neurological Institute, we have a patient that's being monitored continually. This is a young man who's having recurrent generalized seizures. So this is just showing one electrode on the left and one electrode on the right. And you can see, for example, about 18 seconds long, there's a run that looks just like the seizure I showed you before. Okay? And he's having these every couple minutes. Okay? So what I got the technician to do was to drop a trash can on the floor randomly. So some of them he would just let have a regular seizure, and then every once in a while at the beginning of the seizure, drop a trash can on the floor. Okay? And what these records actually show are the average length of the seizure when with no trash can and the average length of a seizure with a trash can. So when you see this, you know, the first thing you do is, oh, the seizure's a lot shorter. Okay? And this is actually an old observation. If you go back to the time of Hippocrates and things like that, mothers would say, when little Johnny, because it's not Johnny, it has to be the Greek equivalent, and I don't know that, but when little Johnny starts to seize, I just shake him, and he pops right out of it, just at the beginning. Where some patients will tell you if they think about another thought when they're about to have a seizure, they can abort the seizure. And so if you look at this, despite all the complexity I just showed you, now there's some hope. Because this suggests like a bistable situation or something like that. So there's some hope. So that's, instead of giving up on epilepsy, let's go back and see if we start looking at things from this point of view. And this slide was put in because I like it, but B, it was just to remind people what bistability is. And so one, you know, the perception of ambiguous figures by the cortex is a famous example of a bistability in the cognitive domain. So here have a skull and a woman, a duck and a, what's the other one? A duck and a rabbit, and a face and a vase. Okay, but you guys already know that, so we'll just go on past that one. And the point of the thing you have to remember in the nervous system is here I've got a cubic nonlinearity. So inside are equations that describe the functions of a neuron, such as the Hodgkin-Huxley equation or the Fitzhugh-Nagumo equation. Any of these exists a cubic nonlinearity. And if you take it, figure out what the potential would be, and so if we were just make sure we have x dot equals f of x, and we can say minus d dx some potential function. Okay, so that just take the integral of that with a negative sign is how I got that. The potential that corresponds to a cubic nonlinearity is a cortic, which is a bistable situation. So it wouldn't be surprising. And in truth, this was showed back in the 1980s, if I have a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, so this would be a squid-gyed axon, for example, firing along periodically, if I put a pulse in at the right time, I can turn it off. Okay. Here's the same experiment now done in an epileptic rat. Okay. And what this is a seizure begins here, I put a single pulse in and stop it. Another one begins here, I don't do anything, put a pulse in just to show that I can actually stop these with single pulses. Okay. And this has led to a whole bunch of people worrying about, could I make a brain defibrillator? In other words, is the right way to teach epilepsy? Forget about, in other words, rather than worrying about propagation, let's try to get it at the beginning. And we get it at the beginning by carefully putting in a little pulse to try to stop it. Okay. Well, I got very interested in this, and I talked to all kinds of friends working in it. And this is Jennifer Foss. And what she's working on here, what she started to work on, is the basic neural circuit in the temporal lobe, in the hippocampus, which is where seizure comes in, is a recurrent inhibitory loop. That is, I have an excitatory neuron here that gives off a branch to an inhibitory loop, which comes back and inhibits. So recurrent inhibitory loop, okay? And what she said is, let's make the simplest possible model I can of that loop. So let's ignore everything. And so what we have is we have a constant current going into that neuron. Okay, it's going to integrate itself out linearly because we want the simplest model. When it hits a threshold, it should spike, reset itself at zero, and begin over again. Okay, when it spikes, if it has a inhibitory loop, that means that when there's a spike, there's this going on, but at some time tau later, we have an inhibitory pulse coming through. Okay. Now, if we set this up right, we can have zero down here and one, so this is slope one. So one case you already know. Suppose this tau here is shorter than 1. When it's shorter than 1, that means that the period is going to be 1 plus delta. Okay, which is just the offset here. So all those solutions are just simply periodic. Okay, what happens now if I make tau longer than 1? When tau is longer than 1, it means that the inhibitory pulse is no longer due to the excitatory pulse immediately before it, but due to someone in the past. And when you have this going on, now you have multiple solutions coexisting. So a simple choice of parameters, this just is illustrative. The numbering just has to do with how many inhibitory pulses are there between two adjacent excitatory ones. So here there's 00005, so a bursting pattern. All these coexist, okay? And of course, you can flip back and forth and do whatever you want with them. So here you're going from one pattern like that, you put a pulse in here, and it changes over. And here's the same experiment, and we really got excited about this. This is the same experiment, except now I have a living neuron here, and I'm making the computer pretend to be the inhibitory neuron in the recurrent loop. Here are the two different patterns that exist, and you can flip back and forth between the different patterns. So you can do it with living neurons. And here, Yang Hung Wu and Yang Fu Ma, who I guess is somewhere in the United States, actually extended what Jennifer had done. And the interesting thing is these little recurrent loops have countably large number of coexisting attractors, all different by their firing patterns, which I think is an amazing thing. I don't think it has too much to do with epilepsy, but it is interesting that in an area of the brain that has to do with memory, a simple circuit like this already can store large numbers of patterns. And for those of you who are computer scientists, I always wonder, well, if I have a computer that does 0 and 1, suppose I made a computer of these loops, so instead of 0 and 1, I have a very large number of possibilities at each little node in my computer. What could you do? And no one has figured that out. So we kind of went over there, and we got to the point here, because when I came to this point, I realized, well, the problem here is the first one I told you about. This is a two-event solution for epilepsy. And in a way, I'd rather go for one event, because that's not what I'm really interested in. Not trying to get too far away from the cortex. So what we've done is we started off worrying that the connections were something that was important, but so important that I probably can't do much about it. Okay, even the connectivity in terms of making bistability is really important, but what other anatomical feature might be important? And the one thing that's really curious about the brain is we have two kinds of neurons. We have excitatory ones and inhibitory ones, to be really simple, but the excitatory ones greatly outnumber the inhibitory ones. The first thing you would ask yourself, well, why isn't it the neurons just don't fire all the time? Which is not true. It turns out that if you were just to go and pick an arbitrary neuron somewhere in your brain and ask if it's firing at that time or not, you'd actually find it silent. So 98% of your neurons are actually silent most of the time. They only fire when they need to, when there's some task that they have to compute. So how can this be true that I have a cortex that's mostly excitatory and yet I don't see a lot of firing? I don't have seizures all the time. Why don't people have seizures all the time? And so one of the ideas came out that the If you imagine that, remember that I have this cortical layer up here and I have these deep nuclei down here, that maybe these deep nuclei somehow inhibit or control this cortical layer that's sitting here. So in other words, this cortical layer is more or less sitting on an edge of stability. So I release a little bit, it starts firing and things like that. Well, if you start thinking, well, if it's something that's on the edge of stability, and you might think about that mean, well, maybe the cortex is not so interested in stability, maybe it's interested in maneuverability, being able to change quickly, all that would begin to sort of make sense. Well, that's what true, you'd say, well, there has to be power law behaviors here. Because if you're a physicist and you put something up at the edge of stability, you start wondering about all these weird and wonderful things. Well, here's another few years of my life. Now I get, so I'm mentioning at the meeting, and lo and behold comes Ivan Osorio, who is runs the Epilepsy Center at Kansas University Medical Center, okay? And Didier Sornet, who many of you may know, is the guy on Critical Phenomena, very, very famous. Famous right now for Dragon Kings. I don't know if you've got, the students love about black swans and Dragon Kings, so predicting economics. He's the only guy that when he makes a prediction for what the stock market is about to do, he gives the hour and the seconds. You know, and I think one time he was only off by 10 hours, which I think is pretty good, you know. Arrogant, though. Okay, fair enough. And so what we did is we said, well, let's start measuring the times between seizure occurrences. Okay, and now plot the probability that essentially the probability that the seizures occur between a certain time versus their frequency. Okay, and let's look at earthquakes, which is the solid blue line here. And let's look at human seizures, which are these two little lines here. Okay? And both of them, if you want to be sort of thinking about, have a linear relationship, okay, over many decades with a power law exponent of around 1.67. Okay, it's interesting. In fact, you can do a whole bunch of statistics and show that you can't distinguish the statistics between earthquakes and epilepsy. That doesn't mean earthquakes cause epilepsy. It's just they have the same kinds of power law behaviors. So if you have populations of relaxation oscillators, you can prove that these kinds of power laws should have happened. Or if you have a system that's tuned right at the edge of stability and you have a control parameter that's being stochastically forced back and forth across that boundary, you'll get a power law with -3/2. Okay, so 3/2, which is 3/2 is almost 1.67. But then if you look at this really carefully, okay, you notice that every once in a while these plots, especially if you look in different individuals, have little bumps in them. Right, so this one, I might be able to convince you my blue one is pretty good, and maybe some here. But this one, you kind of wonder, well, is that really the same power law or something like that? Well, you have to remember, if you think about the brain, we know we have all these rhythmic behaviors in it. So there would have to be somehow a coexistence, maybe, between the power law behavior and these underlying rhythms. You know, like epilepsy tends to want to be 3 hertz spike and wave, or 4 hertz or something like that, 2 hertz and things like that. And so there's surely going to be characteristic time scales in here that you might get little bumps like that. And it turns out, and this is an animal experiment now, if I take rats, okay, and here's the same thing in rats, it's a common laboratory rat, and then I decrease inhibition by giving the rat a medication, stops the synthesis of the inhibitory transmitter, I now get a little bump in their thing. In other words, if I give them the inhibitor, I now start seeing a lot of 3 hertz spike and wave. And so when you look in these systems, there's going to be I think it's coextensive. That word might mean more to the mathematicians than to me, but depending on what your parameters are and your coupling and things like that, you could have pure synchronization or self-organized criticality or coexistence of the two or some incoherent kind of the behavior. So all those behaviors exist in that kind of system. So in a way, in some sense, the cortical mantle of the brain behaves like a complex system. Okay, so then I got really excited and said, well, what do I know about controlling things at the edge of stability? I guess you guys might know something I don't. And the problem we started working on was stick balancing at the fingertips. So in other words, if I can't understand a really complicated system, it's kind of hard to deny those power law-like behaviors that kind of want to motivate you to kind of do things. Can I go back and look at a system that I might think I was going to understand? This is the crazy example that most of you have done for summer students, right? We had got some money left over in our NIH grant, about $50,000 that I had to spend. And my two nephews had told me about these motion capture cameras that were company. If you're into the I think it's called Dragonheart, where Sean Connery plays, Sean Connery 007 plays a dragon. And what they did is they covered his body in these little and watched him move through it and superimposed the dragon on the markers. That's how the movie was done. And I said, that sounds like a fun kind of thing. And it turns out $50,000 buys you two of them. And so my plan was to give a summer student an inverted pendulum with a delay in it. That can't be too hard. Sue Ann and I know how many years have we now wasted on this program, okay? And the student should just be able to do this, collect the data at the same time, and we'll write it up by the end of the summer, paper. Now, that was 10 years ago, maybe, okay? A few things you should notice is that, so these little markers here on the end of the stick, there's one here and one on the top, okay? So around these cameras, we're going to send out infrared light. The infrared light is going to bounce back off and be collected by the cameras. Each camera does X and Y coordinates as a function of time. Two together triangulate to give you X, Y, and Z. Okay, and so you get data measured at about 25 microns at 1,000 hertz. So 1 millisecond, really good resolution and things like that. We were playing with this experiment, and my colleague Juan Luis Cabrera arrives from Venezuela, and he says, he comes in the first day only speaking a few words of English, watches what we're doing, we show him the data, and he looks at the data and says, I know exactly what's going on here. Now I'm going to show you the data. That's what was going on. So we're measuring the angle. So we're measuring the displacement angle because if you look at her eyes, she is always looking at that dot. So our idea was that she must be measuring the displacement angle. And we kind of proved that because if she now, you force her to look at here, she gets the same balancing result that she would have got with a stick that's only that length. Now, the mathematicians always tell me, what if you went to the limit right down here to the bottom, what's going to happen? Like at some point, this analogy doesn't work. You actually can't balance the stick if you try to look at that. You have to look up there. The other thing you should know, which we're actually very curious about, is everybody adopts the same position when they are balancing a stick and become very expert, where you have to keep your elbow stiff, your hand stiff, and you move everything in the shoulder. I would think that this particular stick, which is about this long, most people in the room will be able to balance it less than 10 seconds. That would be an average time. An expert, a true expert, will do over 10 minutes. So there's a huge way. So we got very interested in this sort of stuff. Here's what the data looks like. The data looks like the angle is always changing all over the place. Okay. But what you do, these are two different stick lengths, but I'm only one different height. Okay, so I put an imaginary threshold in here, okay, and I look at the crossings in the upward position. So remember, this is cosine the angle. So when I'm vertical, cosine of vertical zero is one. Excuse me, vertical displacement angle is zero. And what I wanted to have measure the times between the successive crossings in the upward direction. So I do lots of these. Maybe I get 500,000 of this, which means you're collecting lots and lots of data, taking the whole afternoon and things like that. And then I'm going to put the probability that the crossing time is some delta t versus delta t as a log-log plot. And what I get is a straight, more or less straight line. Now, this is really, you should be looking at the black ones. The red ones are pooled. That's going to turn out to be a dragon king, but we're not talking about that right now. So there's a line in there which has a slope of -3/2. In fact, that's what that black line is. The curious thing is if I put in where the time delay is, so in other words, there's a time delay, right? Because when the nervous system sees the stick angle move, okay, it takes a certain time to make a correction, okay? 98% of the corrective movements are faster than the time delay, right? Because this is one problem that Michael Mackey and I had never thought about, which is like the obvious problem. If you have a time delay for red blood cells of 7 days, what happened for the other 6 days, 23 hours, 59 seconds? Okay, and the same thing with balancing a stick on the fingertip. What happens for the time in between the time delays? How do you make corrections? How does the system actually keep it up here? And what this is saying is something in these corrections that is actually giving you corrective movements over all time scales. Okay, and what was the thing? Well, this is a... There's an equation up there, believe it or not, which is just the equation of an inverted pendulum. But the term on the farthest right, which I can't quite reach, is the feedback. So this is the simplest case. We haven't even got a derivative term in the feedback, just the simplest case. And this R, this gain, constant plus a noise term. Okay? And we're going to look at the behavior of this equation as a function of that constant and the time delay. Okay? And there's a stability region that looks like this. Okay? And these are four different choices of where you would pick those parameters. So, for example, if you pick it up on this boundary, the stick would go off to infinity, which means it falls. Okay? If you pick down here in the middle of the stability region, there are no fluctuations because it's a stable fixed point. Okay? If you you reproduce the statistics. So what's all this to say about anything? Well, it means that the way this is happening, and I have this is what back and forth. And you do that. Well, let's think about this for a second. That's to be just simple-minded mathematicians. Right on the boundary, the real part is zero, right? So if I have noise going back and forth on either side, sort of symmetrically distributed, that then I'm actually going to maintain that position for free just because of the noise in the system. So in the stick balancing thing, what it's telling us is up on this boundary between our two basins of attraction, if there's a delay and noise thing, there can be some stabilization up at that point. Okay, and that was a kind of an important clue. So in other words, if I'm sitting here, if you have no delay in the system, you know that I go from here, I change my initial condition from over here. We never think about this unstable point up there. But if there's noise and delay together, that system point up here can be transiently stabilized. That's what's basically happening in stick balancing. See, what we're worrying about is that what the nervous system does when it learns to do this test? Is it not calculating anything? Is it just simply setting it up and letting noise do all the work? Now, let's get ourselves back to epilepsy. Well, here's the strangest thing. I live in a world where every few months I get a strange phone call. Okay? And I've always, because of my father, you can see of a goaltender who breaks his arm, I'm always willing to give it a go. So this is the NFLE symposium. And you see, I got myself here, and there's what did this to me. This is the strangest conference I've ever been to in my life because more than 60% of the people who are the speakers have no idea what NFLE is. That's why I haven't told you what NFLE is, okay? And Ivan gave us the task from our own perspective when we see the clinical data to propose an explanation from our own field. So this is where I am. We have only 4 weeks to do this. The idea which I'm going to tell you, which kind of motivated this talk, but I think I've given you enough background to start thinking about it, was developed while I was sitting in my bathtub literally playing with my rubber ducky. Okay? So that's how complicated this is. Okay, here we go. So the challenge was, so we had 50% speakers had never heard of it. Okay, we were supposed to discuss it as best we can, come up with a model, and we had 1 month to do it. What is nocturnal frontal lobe epilepsy? So this is a particular kind of epilepsy that's mostly discovered in Europe. It probably exists in North America. In fact, all of us decided who had seen patients before that we probably had patients that have this. Okay, they have a known defect in one of their central nicotinic acetylcholine ion channels. There's one of the problems the molecular biologists don't like to talk about. If you have a defect in a channel that's permanent, why don't you seize all the time? There's a problem there. So they don't seize all the time. Their seizures only occur when they're sleeping. And in particular, if you just remember, if you remember sleep, you have 4 stages of slow wave sleep and 1 stage of rapid eye movement sleep. So it occurs at the transitions. So particularly when I go from stage 1, which is drowsiness, to my first stage of sleep, that's the most common. Then from 2nd to 3rd, that's the second most common. 3rd to 4th, the 4th most common. So they only happen at that. Okay. And some nights they don't have seizures. So how can you have a seizure at a time during a transition? What would be a model that would begin to explain this? So my idea, okay, is really simply just shown here. Let's just imagine that stage 1, you know, each of our stages is asleep are characterized by a basin of attraction, okay? And then as I'm changing from one stage to the next stage, there must be a new basin of attraction that develops and eventually replaces the other one. Which means somewhere in the middle, there has to be a bistable state right at the transition. Right? That's what you would think. OK? Okay, so there's going to be a coexistence of these guys do it, and you can kind of draw it out on paper, but somewhere in the middle, as one attractor disappears and the other one appears, there must be a time when both of them coexist. Okay? And so there are my stages of sleep. And I had another person who's in here in the audience this time, and her and I had been doing another model that made this, which actually set this other model up. We wrote a paper called Indecision Neural Decision Making Model. So why would somebody at a liberal arts college write a paper called Indecision in Neural Decision Making Models? Well, because if you're in a liberal arts college right now, there are faculties developed towards decision making. Okay, in fact, we just got a $20 million grant for a decision making faculty. Okay, and every meeting is on how rational decision making is and all these sorts of stuff, and I thought that was getting to be a too much because I don't think of decision making, at least in my life, as being rational. Okay, and so we picked up this little model where we have two reciprocally inhibited neurons. This is a standard decision making model. Okay, there's nothing particularly fancy about it, and it has two fixed points. You can pick the parameters so that you have three fixed points coexisting. These two are stable and one is unstable. So there we have our bistable situation set up. But remember, whereas in an ODE we could write down a nice picture, the pictures are now cartoons because in the delay system we're in infinite dimensions and we really can't draw it. Okay. And then the issue was, what happens in this little area here? And the curious thing that happens, so in other words, if I try to switch this system across that boundary, okay, I can get delayed-induced transient oscillations, which is very interesting because these two fixed points are both stable fixed points. There's no oscillation here. In the set of parameters we have, there is no oscillation, and yet around its separatrix, we have an oscillation, which is exactly the answer what I want, because you know what I'm going to say now. I'm going to say, well, the oscillation is the seizure. Okay, the seizure is interesting. Once I start it, it also has a fixed stop time. I don't have to do anything to stop it. It's going to do it. And when is it going to happen? Well, it's going to happen when my two attractors sort of coexist. If you think of my mechanism as one is disappearing and the other one's appearing, I'm almost pushing the system right up to the separatrix. So kind of, that's a bathtub solution, okay? And so here's what one of them look like. Okay, I don't know which one of them we're showing, but the system is going here. There's where actually the boundary between the two attractors is, and the system gets hung up here for a long time and then spirals out of it. So that's what it would look like if you were drawing, I think, X versus Y. So we're showing both solutions, but it gets stuck up there for, you know, how long can it be stuck up there? Well, it depends on how you choose. Here's one that's 1,000 times the delay, okay, or here's 100, depending on how you pick the delay, many, many, many times the delay, so much longer than the delay. I think if you pick this particular one here, it's about the average length of an epileptic seizure, which would be about 1.5 minutes. That's temporal lobe seizures. Okay. And so the idea was that, you know, now can you map out what this region is? So in the bistability, what is the probability with some noise as I go from my stage one sleep attractor to my stage two sleep attractor? What's the probability that I will get a delayed-induced transient oscillation there? Now, there's some noise in the system, so it's not going to be a sure thing. There's going to be some probability. And so what happens is that if you juggle generously the model, okay, and try to take the model and try to... So the only parameters we really can change are the two inputs, okay, and you can imagine that with an acetylcholine defect that might happen, because the acetylcholine sort of sets the tone, if you want, to all the neurons. That's what the acetylcholine inputs do. Depending on when you do this, you can get it so that the probability of a... So these colors... blue is the lowest probability up to dark red, which is the highest probability of a delayed-induced transient oscillation. And you can juggle the parameters, so there would be ways of crossing this separatrix without having a very high probability of making a ditto or a seizure. And there could be other ways when you are able to cross there, you would have a much higher probability. And by higher probability, we mean like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100. So these are low probability events, which is exactly what you want. When you do hit one, you end up with your seizure that's going to last for a couple minutes, and exactly what we want. So that's what we're kind of thinking about. And it all came, if you want, randomly out of a selective bunch of experiments we were trying to do, following our noses to see if we could explain anything. I mean, I would never have got to this model had I been rational about this. But I never would have ever thought about it because I didn't know such behaviors exist. So the thing we started wondering about is a brain, does it have an increased susceptibility to doing things like a seizure when it's trying to change its states. Now, I talked only about sleeping states, but there could be cognitive states. You know, some patients think about, you know, if you think your mind in a certain way, is that like giving you a state that this would happen? Are these funny little oscillations that we look at, are they really the seizure, or are they some kind of other part of it? We don't know, okay? We don't know how to measure states. So this is a typical mathematic issue. You define something, what does it classify correspond to in the real world? Okay, you know, if you right now we're trying to work on how you would stage the EEG to be able to detect one of these things. This is not a trivial problem, right? If you think about it, because does having one of these dittos actually change your EEG signatures? Most people don't stage sleep in patients who also have epilepsy. So there's nothing like that. We've asked the clinicians to try to figure out, is it absolutely true to the best guess you can make that these seizures are exactly happening on the transition, or could they be a little bit before, a little after, so people are worrying about these sorts of things. And of course, you could now use your little stimuli to stop one of these things from happening. Every time it kind of popped into one of these states, you could try to use your stimuli then to kind of stop it. So a major part of a small number of people in the epilepsy community have started working on this particular disease to see if we can understand this one particular thing. And if we can, then maybe we can actually do a little bit better when we get to more run-of-the-mill kinds of epilepsy and things by applying the same techniques. So that's where we are. Okay. Thank you. I left time for questions. Don't throw things. If you have to throw something, just throw money. Okay. Yeah, any questions? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So when you're talking about the multi-stability and the edge of stability,
yeah.
So I'm just talking about the difference between the first order phase transition and the second order phase transition.
First order, yeah, first order, yeah, that's right.
First order phase is the multi-stability, but when you're talking about
what I'm talking about, I always get first and second order transitions wrong, so I may not exactly understand what you're talking about. Yeah. What I'm actually talking about is here. Because this is on the edge, this is truly on the edge of stability, because I either could go here or there. And when there's no delay, it would be just simply unstable, and that would be the end of the discussion. Okay. But when there's a delay and some noise, this is kind of complicated. Okay. So that's why I was saying, if there's a message for the modelers, those of us who try to come up from the groundwork from experiments are getting very, very concerned about what really is going on here. Is there something that's useful for the nervous system? In this particular case of making epilepsy, it's not so good. On the other hand, if you're a stick balancer, it's good. But so there are funny phenomena that happen here. Okay, so for example, in an unstable system with an unstable fixed point with a delay, you can transiently stabilize the system with some noise. So, and the reason we like this in neuroscience is noise is for free. You don't have to compute noise, we hope. Okay.
And I got it from people saying that it's like pendulum.
Yeah.
If you have a pendulum, that can be stabilized. It's like just shaking.
Well, the curious thing is, this is one of my favorite, don't get me going on pendulums, you guys are lost, okay? So you know that if I have a pendulum that's physically attached to a pivot point, okay, and I vibrate the pivot point at a certain frequency and amplitude, I can stabilize the inverted position upright forever. That's a well-known phenomenon. You can do it with a jigsaw if you want. But when you're balancing a stick on the fingertip, the stick is not physically attached to your finger, okay? So as a liberal arts college student, if I was at University of Chicago, I would have told the students that, and that would have been the end of the discussion, because I would have been sitting up on a pulpit. But at a liberal arts college, we don't have that option. So a group of kids really felt that we should go and experimentally study this, because they pointed out quite rightly that there's a delay in the system, so how could you be so sure? And so over a three-year period, we actually started balancing sticks on your fingertip while your whole body is being vibrated. Now, the first thing you find out when you do that experiment is you have to bend your knees a little bit, or you'll knock the teeth out of your head. Okay, and what happens when you bend your knees a little bit? Well, it turns out your body is a really amazing second-order low-pass filter. And so if you get your feet vibrating at about 3 to 5 millimeters, at your fingertip, that becomes about 100 microns. Okay, so imagine you're standing on this thing, everything's vibrating, news like that, and it turns out that, it is true that you actually increase prolong the time you're able to balance the stick in that situation. And we're actually trying to understand there's some kind of strange parametric stabilization thing that goes on in the system with a delay. We have a Mickey Mouse model that works, okay, and we've been asking mathematicians to try to figure out why it actually works. But there is a stabilization there that goes on in the system. So that's, again, another example of what's going on here is very different than what you would have thought from a world that has no delays. Well, you can measure them, okay, that's true. The nervous system has a... Yeah, we use what we measure. Okay. The nervous system has this ability to change its delays because the induction time of an axon depends on how much myelin is on the outside, how much insulation is on it, and you can vary the amount of insulation on it and change the conduction velocity. So it actually has. So this raises a question about, in fact, Yang Hong Wu was kind enough to help us out and show, I don't know if anybody here does these artificial neural networks, but when you do an artificial neural network, you have to put a hidden layer in there, and the hidden layer has to have all these recurrent loops. And the problem with that is that that doesn't exist in the anatomy of the brain. But on the other hand, what Yang Hong Wu was sort of able to show is that this ability of the axon to change its conduction velocity, together with the fact that there's a lot of information when you conduct down an axon that goes as e to the minus tau, whatever the length is, those two things together allow you to bypass this hidden layer problem. So maybe it's important that the neurons can adjust their insulation so they can do it. Okay, and of course, you know, you could ask me, well, what about epilepsy? What's happening? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Yeah. Yeah. Well, if Didier was here, he would now give you an hour lecture. But from my point of view, it's because both are multiplied by populations of relaxation oscillators. And that, to me, is the similarity. You know, what exactly is the mechanism that does that, whether it's pair box, sand piles, or exactly what. But the models that are actually are underlying both for epilepsy and seizures turn out to be remarkably similar when you get into the nitty-gritty of doing that. And so his argument would be that these are simply phenomena that you see in a population of relaxation oscillators. And that's why the similarity is. Now, when he's talking similarity, I think the linearity of a log-log plot, as you know from high school, is a great way to get through an exam, a lab that you didn't do so well. But that's not enough to show that there's really a power law there. You have to use many different kinds of statistics. So I think there's like six statistics that he actually used to show that these are both power law phenomena. So it's not an easy thing to do. But that's the way I look at it. So the reason we were into it was, could some of the tools that people use to predict earthquakes be used to predict seizures? Okay. And this is the idea. If I could predict a seizure before it happens, then maybe I could tell somebody to sit down rather than drive their car at the moment or something like that. So that's one of the ideas. Now, that's the guys who want to predict so you do nothing. And I always say, well, if Sandy Koufax has decided to throw a fastball at your head, it doesn't really matter. You're not going to be able to sit down fast enough before him to do it. But on the other hand, if you wanted to set something up to actually put a pulse in there to stop it, the same information would be really useful. So I turn this thing on when I know something's coming 5 minutes from now. I'm all ready to go. When it starts, bang, I hit it, and that's the end of it. So that's why people were interested in that. So we were looking at it from that point of view. The interesting thing is that we got into a discussion about, which Didier had not thought of, was what happens if you have these preferred frequencies. Because we know the brain activity wants to oscillate at certain preferred frequencies, and these appear as these bumps in the power law. So these, and that would again show you that you have to be very careful from the linearity of a line to conclude there was a power law. You'd have to, because all this is going to be going on. So if you have perfectly linear data in a brain, it's probably wrong. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, this is a bathtub model, okay, and I was amazed that I didn't, at least they seemed to like it. So what we don't know is almost everything about the model, okay? We don't know how good the data is saying that the seizures in NFLE start right at the transitions, okay? And the other problem is even if we thought we could go study that, we don't actually know how to measure that. And the reason is if somebody's having epilepsy and it's really happening at the time of transitions, does that change the criteria that the EEG uses to stage the EEG? So there's a kind of a fundamental thing. The model, it gets really difficult because What we assumed is that in the normal operation, the thalamus and the cortex, which are actually connected to each other, aren't well synchronized. And so that means they're not those two activities are coherent, so you could kind of ignore the input of the cortex coming back. And that actually, if you do that, you can actually reduce a real model down to something that looks very close to what Sue Ann did. But of course, once the seizure begins, then of course the cortex circuit has to kick in. And we have no idea how to model that. Okay, so we don't really have a full model to actually allow the EEGers to predict and things like that. And the last question is how would you actually establish this model? And that's when I don't know for sure. So it's a good conceptual one that, to raise this question that when the brain is changing states, does it somehow increase its vulnerability? The reason it increases its vulnerability is because with a delay in noise, it's possible to stabilize the unstable state transiently. That's the kind of prediction. Okay, now how you prove that, I don't know. Okay, but I think it's kind of something interesting to think about, that this might be where it is. Is it also true for the timing of other seizures, that they're occurring at changes of state, if we allow it to have cognitive states and all the other kinds of states going on? Yeah, I'd love to do that. So this is an argument I get with people. I'd love to be able to put noisy stimulators into the brain. Because, you know, right now we have many trials going on where people are, you know, have like basically little defibrillators sitting there detecting, and you put a stimulus in. There's another kind where they just constantly put this stimulus in. That's the standard way of doing it. But nobody's ever thought about putting a noisy stimulus in. And nobody who's running a clinical trial has thought about that, but I think it's not a bad idea, at least to try. Well, the interesting thing is Canada, you know, was very interested in this kind of approach very long. There's a guy named Forster who was in one of the Ontario universities, but I forget which one, and he had these photogenic epilepsies. He actually made a pair of glasses that on one side would actually measure something like the EEG from maybe one electrode, and then the other ear made a noise. And he found out that with people with Lennox-Gastaut epilepsy, which is a very difficult refractory epilepsy, you could set the timing so that this actually worked. You had a few patients that actually got better with these crazy glasses, but it was so labor-intensive. Because remember, this guy was doing it before the theory of phase resetting and all this sort of stuff came along, and no one's ever gone back to do that. But his case was so labor-intensive, it took him months to get this, all the little settings correct to get the experiment to work. And then the question would argue about, you can imagine what they'd argue about, sampling error and on it goes. But it was amazing it worked for somebody. And so this idea of trying different noises and stimuli, you know, we have the same thing when you're walking. So if, I don't know if anybody here is yet old enough that they start falling. And so what happens when you fall? Well, when you fall, you realize that your whole life you've been walking and all of a sudden it's not going so good. So you actually look at your feet and walk like this very tentatively, which actually increases your risk of falling. So what do you do for instruction to the people? Is you get them to look away, and you let the noise control their walking. You know, so it's the same kind of thing. In other words, stabilize it a little more, or knock them off with using noise or music or something. Okay. Of course, there's a take-home exam, and I want you guys all to do the answers over the weekend, and just mail them to me on Monday. It's okay. And if you need an extension for a day or two, you got it. Okay, thank you.